Well, good morning. It is July 14th, 2020, and this is the Morning Bible Study. Now, we did in the past, in our sermon material, we did cover the death of Absalom. So if you want to look at that material, what we see in chapter 18 and then part of chapter 19, if you're interested in reading that, then I would recommend scrolling through and finding the appropriate sermon for that. But we're going to pick up in chapter 19, verse 8, the second half of chapter 8, and we're going to pick up there. The Net Bible makes the break about halfway through verse 8 of chapter 19. Where is the NIV? The NIV breaks it. The NIV breaks it right at verse 8. Between verses 8 and 9. So, you know, we could probably check a bunch of different, you know, Bible versions and see where they make that transition. But for our purposes today, why don't you go ahead and read basically chapter 19 verses, just read chapter 19 verses 9 through the end of the chapter through verse 43, and then unpause your audio, and then we're going to look at the text. Okay, so as you know, we have been going through the text and we've been looking at the downfall of Absalom, which is part of the judgment of God against David for his sin with Bathsheba and against Uriah, well, against Bathsheba as well, but specifically against Uriah the Hittite. And if you want to look at the death of Absalom itself, then go to our sermons in the Through the Bible sermon section. And from February 16th, 2020 is the sermon, The Death of Absalom. And that was a Sunday morning sermon. So you can listen into that and get a little more detailed information. But like I said, we're going to go ahead and skip forwards we're going to look at David returning to Jerusalem. So you read ahead, you read verses 9 through the end of chapter 19, and we're going to dive right into the text. So all the people, I'm going to paraphrase here, all the people are basically saying, you know, David is the one who fought our battles. He rescued us from the Philistines. He ran away from Absalom, but Absalom, whom we anointed, is dead. So why aren't we bringing David back? And so David sent this message to Zadok and Abiathar, or Abiathar, however you want to pronounce that, the priests. And he says, ask the elders of Judah, why should you be the last to bring the king back to his palace, since what is being said throughout Israel has reached the king at his quarters? You are my relatives, my own flesh and blood, so why should you be the last to bring back the king? And say to Amasa, are you not my own flesh and blood? May God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if you are not the commander of my army for life in place of Joab. Okay, now I'm reading that from the NIV. I read that specifically out of the NIV text because I think that that draws out pretty well what's going on. And it's really interesting how closely that mirrors what the Net Bible has. You know, he says, are you not my own flesh and blood? Are you not my own flesh and blood? The literal is my bone and flesh. And then he gives this imprecation and he says, may God deal with me, be it ever so severely. The Net Bible says, may God punish me severely if from this time on you are not the commander of my army in the place of Joab. Why is Joab being removed? I mean, that's a really good question. Well, we have all sorts of reasons why Joab is being removed. Probably, most recently, because he killed Absalom despite the king's direct orders, right? Now, Joab believed what he was doing was right. I think Joab thought that what he was doing was ending the rebellion and ending the problems in the household of David. He thinks he's doing the best that he can. And so David sees this as a way to make peace with the former rebels and also a way to keep a close family member to both he and Joab. Putting him in charge would maybe placate Joab, and he could tell Joab, he says, hey, look, you know, Joe, you're getting a little older, you know, you're getting a little long in the tooth, and here's a young guy, he's young, he's scrappy, you know, he's ready to take over the mantle, and he's our flesh and blood. And so he sends word, and they ask the people to come back. And he won over the hearts of all the men of Judah as though they were one man. And they sent word to the king saying, return, you and all your servants as well. And so the king returned and came to the Jordan River. So what is this whole conversation even about in the first place? Well, the whole conversation is about the fact that there were stirrings throughout the entire nation of, hey, you know, it's time to bring David back. You know, this whole rebellion thing wasn't really a great idea. And we really need to have the king back. But what happened was that people weren't really sure in Judah what to do, because, you know, probably a lot of the people in Judah had sided with Absalom, and there were these discussions, and basically what happens from this point on is, believe it or not, a very contemporary thing. We see this throughout all of history, and what happens is essentially a loyalty test. David sends word to the Judeans because he's heard rumors and rumblings about the people bringing David back to the throne, but he hadn't had anything from Judah. And he's like, hey, you guys are my own tribe. You know, why should you guys be the last ones to talk about bringing me back? And he's basically saying, look, why should the people from Dan be talking about bringing me back to Jerusalem when the people who live in Jerusalem aren't even talking about it? Like, why would you guys be the last ones? Come on. And so he's bringing people back. He's bringing them in. And there's kind of this loyalty test. He's like, are you the least loyal of all the people? Like, you're my own tribe. Are you the least loyal? Now, we pick up the story again in the second half of verse 15. Now, the people of Judah had come to Gilgal to meet the king and to help him cross the Jordan. And Shimei, son of Gera the Benjamite from Bahurim, came and down quickly with the men of Judah to meet King David. There were 1,000 men from Benjamin with him, along with Ziba, the servant of Saul's household, and with him his 15 sons and 20 servants. They hurriedly crossed the Jordan within sight of the king. They crossed at the ford in order to help the king's household cross and to do whatever he thought appropriate. Now remember, who's Shimei? Remember, Shimei was the guy who was cursing David, throwing rocks at him, throwing rocks at his soldiers, and saying, get out, you bloody man, get out, you man of blood. God is repaying you for the blood of the house of Saul, which you shed. Which, by the way, David never shed any blood, to this point at least, from the household of Saul. And so Shimei's accusations are completely foolish. Now, to be fair, there were people probably within the household of Saul, or at least the extended Benjamite family who died in the civil war against David. But blaming that on David is really kind of it's a very bizarre and very irrational and unfair accusation. David's done enough bad things. We don't need to make stuff up to make him try to look bad, right? So Shimei realizes that God has brought him back and David is the king again. And Shimei goes to the king to help him cross the fords to bring him back. Why? What did he do? He was saying, get out, get out, get out. He was cursing him and throwing rocks at him and saying, leave the country. But now he's helping the king cross back in. So it's not only is it he's apologizing, he's showing what he's done is wrong, but he's undoing what he tried to do. He tried to make the king leave. Now he's helping the king return. And he threw himself down before the king and he said to the king, don't think badly of me, my lord, and don't recall the sin of your servant on the day when you, my lord, the king, left Jerusalem. Please don't call it to mind, for I, your servant, know that I sinned, and I have come today as the first of all the house of Joseph to come down to meet my lord, the king. Okay, so what is he saying? He's saying, I know what I did was wrong. Please forgive me. And to show you how sorry I am, I am the first, not of the house of Joseph, not just Benjamin, but of Benjamin, Ephraim, and Manasseh, of those three tribes. I am the first one here, and I brought 1,000 men with me. I'm the first one bringing 1,000 men to help you come as a sign of my shame, my humiliation, and my sorrow, and I'm willing to swear fealty to you. And Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, replied, for this should not Shimei be put to death. After all, he cursed the Lord's anointed. But David said, what do we have in common, you sons of Zeruiah? You are like my enemy today. Should anyone be put to death in Israel today? Don't you realize that today I'm king over Israel? The king said to Shimei, you won't die. And the king vowed an oath concerning this. Okay, so this is significant. This is a very important thing. Take verse 23. Read it like about 20 times in your head and burn that into your memory, because this becomes very significant at David's death. When David dies, David does some things, and we'll talk about it when we get there, but David cleans house, and he does some things that are at least morally suspicious. We've got some questions about what he commands Solomon to do. But that's another day for another time. But what's the king's point here? He's saying, look, you know, Abishai is saying, look, this guy cursed the king. He deserves to die. And David's like, I'm the king again. Like, what are you doing, Abishai? He's like, he's like, I know that I'm the king. I don't need people's heads lopped off for me to know that I'm the king. He's come here with 1,000 people to bow down and humiliate himself. Like, I know that I'm the king. He knows that I'm the king. He's asked me for forgiveness. What would killing him solve? I mean, really, what at this point, on a day like this, what would killing him solve? Shimei is a very clever man. He knows that this is the perfect time. This is the perfect time to come and seek the king's forgiveness. One, because he's doing it immediately. He's not waiting around. He's not hoping the king will ignore him, because the king's not going to forget this. He's not waiting around hoping that he'll just be left alone. He is actively coming out at the earliest possible moment and showing the king that he realizes he was wrong and that he had sinned. And so he's trying to make good on his apology. And he's doing this in public when loyalties are a little bit questionable. David doesn't know 100% how people are going to respond to him being restored to the throne. I mean, civil wars cause a lot of, you know, upset and a lot of bad feeling and a lot of bitterness. They've had a civil war. And David is doing his best to create coalitions, to create, you know, peace and harmony. Abishai doesn't understand this. Abishai is a blunt instrument. Okay, Abishai knows that anyone who curses the king deserves to die, and so he has no thought of justice. He has only thoughts of justice. He has no thoughts of mercy. He says, he cursed the king. The man who curses the king deserves to die. He deserves to die. Let me kill him. I mean, he's a very bloody man. Abishai is. He knows how to kill people, and that's about the extent of his skill. And David says, what do we even have in common? Well, they have a blood relationship in common, but he's saying, you know, why are you doing this? I know that I'm the king. You know that I'm the king. And guess what? So does Shimei. He knows that I'm the king. He's publicly humiliated himself with 1,000 of his followers. What would killing him do? Let's think about this for a second. What would killing him do? Okay, well, killing him may remind people not to curse the king publicly, but will they curse him in their hearts? Now, I'm not saying that God's law should just be abandoned whenever we feel like it. God clearly gave a reason why there was the law that whoever curses a prince of his people must be put to death. But I think what David sees here is that law, given as a general law, as a general rule, is a good law. And there are certainly times to put to death the one who curses and rebels against his king. But what would killing Shimei solve? Would it bring more loyalty to the throne? Well, maybe. Maybe some of the more fearful and cowardly people would be drawn more into fear of the king. But would it really make people more loyal? I don't think so. And I think that's what David is saying. He's like, this doesn't accomplish anything. Now, we got to continue, because here we pick up the even more interesting portion of this story. Now, Mephibosheth, Saul's grandson, what was Phoebe up to do? That's I call him Phoebe sometimes, you know, but I don't actually. I just made that up right now. But maybe people called him Phoebe. I don't know. Who knows? So Mephibosheth, he comes down to meet the king. And from the day that the king had left until he safely returned, Mephibosheth had not cared for his feet, nor trimmed his mustache, nor washed his clothes. So Mephibosheth was in mourning, deep mourning the entire time. And when he came from Jerusalem to meet the king asked him, "Why didn't you go with me, Mephibosheth?" And he replied, "My lord, the king, my servant deceived me. I said, let me get my donkey saddled so that I can ride on with the king, for I am lame. But my servant slandered me to the Lord my king. But my lord the king is like an angel of God. Do whatever seems appropriate to you. After all, there was no one in the entire house of my grandfather who did not deserve death from my lord the king. But instead, you allowed me to eat at your own table. What further claim do I have to ask the king for anything?" Now, this is interesting. You have two people from the house of Benjamin who have come out to the king. Two people. Shimei, who accuses the king of doing things he never did, and now he apologizes. Shimei, who deserved to die, who accused the king of doing things he didn't do, he's shown mercy. Mephibosheth, who showed nothing but loyalty to the king, as far according to him, and who speaks only the truth about the king and about his own people. He comes out and he's presented to the king, and the king said to him, "Why should you continue speaking like this? You and Ziba will inherit the field together." Mephibosheth said to the king, "Let him have the whole thing. My lord, the king has returned safely to his house." That is fascinating. See, the king, David doesn't know who's telling the truth here. Now, he probably feels like, yeah, Mephibosheth is probably telling the truth, but what if he isn't? What if he isn't? Ziba, I think that what we see here with Mephibosheth is that David was wrong about Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth indeed did want to go with the king, and Ziba really was a sneak, and David did something wrong, but David doesn't know how to make it right because he doesn't know the truth. He went with the information he had, and he made a mistake. And he basically splits the baby. He says, okay, well, you guys are going to share the inheritance. And Mephibosheth, in a sign of amazing grace, says, let him have the whole thing because you've returned safely to your house. That is a slap in David's face. That is a slap in David's face. Mephibosheth, he says, look, my whole family, everybody from the family of my grandfather deserve nothing but death from you because of the way my grandfather treated you. And so, you know, my lord the king must do whatever he feels is right. Because I deserve death. That's what Mephibosheth's saying. He's saying, I deserve death from you because of the way my grandfather treated you. Which, by the way, is a fascinating statement. I don't know that I agree with that theologically, but that's what Mephibosheth is saying. He's saying, I deserve death because of what my grandfather did. So anything you want to do to me between death and nothing is fair, is just. And David says, well, you and Ziba are going to have to split the property. And Mephibosheth's just like, I don't care. He can have it all. I'm just glad that you're back safe. And Mephibosheth, who was shown grace, now becomes the picture of showing grace. Mephibosheth, who was shown grace and mercy and kindness by David, now shows David kindness and mercy and grace. Mephibosheth, he could stick it to David. He could try to rally the Benjamites and the Ephraimites and the Manassites. And he could try to rally support around himself and say, look at what David is doing. He's denying my rights. He could stand on his rights as an inheritor, as a potential inheritor to the throne, because Mephibosheth is a pretender to the crown. The Saulite dynasty is not entirely wiped out. Under the right circumstances, I mean, that was the whole accusation against Mephibosheth, remember? Ziba said to David, Mephibosheth says, you know, my grandfather's kingdom is going to be restored to me. Mephibosheth could try to do that, but he doesn't. He shows grace. And he shows love to David. He received grace, and then he shows grace. And we see the same thing happens with Barzillai, the Gileadite. And he was a very old man, and he had shown all this kindness to the king. And Barzillai said, you know, David says, I want to bring you to live with me in Jerusalem. And Barzillai's like, why? He's basically, I love what he says. Why should I go with you? Why should I go with the king? He's like, I'm 80 years old. Can I discern good and bad? Can I taste what I eat and drink? Am I still able to hear the voices of male and female singers? He's like, I can't even appreciate the good things at your table, so why should I go there? He's like, I'll cross Jordan with you, and I'll go a short way. But why reward me in this way? Let me return so that I may die in my own city near the grave of my father and my mother. But look, here is your servant Kimham. Let him cross over with my lord the king and do for him whatever seems appropriate to you. And the king says, okay, Kimham will cross over with me, and I will do for him whatever I deem appropriate, and whatever you choose, I will do for you. And so, you know, Barzillai's like, look, I'm not going over with you, but here's Kimham. And Kimham is either a son or a grandson or possibly even a great-grandson, and he's obviously in a favored position, and he wants him at court. And David's like, yeah, sure, he can come over with me, and I will do whatever I think is appropriate, and whatever you ask, I'll do for you. Whatever you choose, I will do for you. And he's basically saying Barzillai, he's giving him a blank check. Now, the NIV translates this a little bit differently. And he says, Kimham shall cross over with me, and I will do for him whatever you wish, whatever you wish. Now, that's an interesting differentiation between those two commands. And when we look at the Hebrew text, and I'm going to translate literally from the Hebrew text right here. David says, with me, Kimham shall cross over, and I shall do for him what is good in your eyes, and all which you choose or all which you desire, to him, I shall do for you. And so the question is, why is the NET doing this? Why does the NET have this, you know, this strange translation? The answer is I really actually don't know. I keep looking to see if there's a textual variant here, and I don't see one. So I'm not sure why we have this right here. Honestly, I don't know why the NET translates it that way. This is one of those places where where people who study the Bible, they're like, oh, that's weird. Because the NIV says, I mean, the NIV, I think, is a really good translation here. And you know, we can look at other translations, you know, like right now I'm looking up Young's Literal, you know, so looking at Young's Literal. And we look here at what it has, 2 Samuel 19:38. And the king says, Kimham will go over with me, and I'll do what is good in your eyes. Okay, so let's try another one. Let's go to the ESV. Okay, so the ESV. Everybody loves the ESV. Kimham will go over with me, and I will do for him whatever seems good to you. Okay, so there's another translation. Let's go to another one. Let's go to the King James. I went to the New King James, okay, and I'll do whatever is good for you. Let's try the Old King James. The Old King James says, I will do whatever seems good unto thee. Let's do one more. How about the New Living? I really don't like the New Living, but hey, you know, let's see what it says. And he says, yeah, I'll do whatever you would like. Why does the NET have that? I really don't have any clue whatsoever. I can't tell. There doesn't seem to be any variant translation here. The only thing it could be is if there is a different translation in verse in the Septuagint. And looking at this, and he shall cross over my city. Verse 39, and the king said, with me Kimham shall cross over, and I shall do to him. I'm reading literally from the Greek here, so if it's a little confusing, understand. And I shall do to him what is good in your eyes. So why is the NET like this? I do not know. This is crazy. This is absolute crazy cakes. I don't know what is going on here, so this is why. Okay, this is why, and I have nothing but respect for the translators of the NET Bible. I've been taught by many of them. They're really good translators. Okay, they know the Bible, but sometimes we have things like this, and it's like, oh, was this just a mistake? You know, was this just a mistake in what was put here? I don't know. There's no textual variant that my Biblia Hebraica Stuttgartensia, which is the standard version of the Masoretic text that is the basis for pretty much all Bible translation. Okay, there's no variant text that's listed there. The Septuagint that reads just like all the modern translations except for this one, and all of those translations. I don't know of a single translation that translates this the way the NET Bible does. That's really weird. Okay, that's really weird. Now, what's my point here? What's my point for this little digression? Well, you know, do I have a huge, you know, life-altering point here? I don't have a big life-altering point. My point here is that we have phenomenal Bibles in our language. We have phenomenal Bibles in our language. But here's the deal. It's good to read different versions of the Bible. It's good too. And why is it good to read different versions of the Bible? Well, if you're a person who doesn't have training in Greek and Hebrew, you are reliant upon translators. Okay, you're reliant on them. And that's fine. That's fine. Most people will never gain sufficient skill in Greek and Hebrew and Aramaic to be able to work through the entire Bible in the original languages on their own. That's okay. That's not bad. I think more people should. I think there are a lot of lay people who are more than capable. There are a lot of incredibly intelligent and very capable lay people who really can and should, because they can probably outshine a lot of us clergy members in their ability. But if you don't have those skills, it's important to compare different versions of the Bible. It's important to get exposure, because every translation is an interpretation. Now, let me say that again. Every translation is an interpretation. Now, does that mean that I believe that modern English translations are not trustworthy? Of course not. Do I think that they're not appropriate? Of course not. Of course not. But what it does mean is that they all have flaws. They all have errors. They all make interpretive decisions that may or may not be more or less correct. And so it's important to have exposure to other versions, especially if you're doing serious study in a passage of scripture. It's important to compare various translations. And then if you get stumped, right, like you come up to something like this, where you read a bunch of different translations and you run into this and you're like, what on earth? Why is the NET saying this? Well, then you can go to a pastor, you can go to somebody like me who has the experience and the tools and the resources, and I can look at it and I can join you in saying, yeah, I have no clue. So it's you can do something like that. So I don't know why. I can't tell you, but I would say that I would not trust the NET's rendering here. I don't think that that's appropriate. I don't think that I think it's a mistake. But we must move on. So he basically says, you know, I want you to give this guy a place at court. And all the people crossed over. The king had kissed and blessed him. Barzillai returned to his home. The king crossed over to Gilgal. Kimham crossed over with him. And all the soldiers of Judah, along with half of the soldiers of Israel, helped the king cross over. Then all the men of Israel began coming to the king. They asked the king, why did our brothers, the men of Judah, sneak the king away and help the king and his household to cross the Jordan? And not only him, but all of David's men as well. And all of the men of Judah replied to the men of Israel, because the king is our close relative. Why are you upset about this? Have we eaten at the king's expense, or have we misappropriated anything for our own use? The men of Israel replied to the men of Judah, we have 10 shares in the king, and we have a greater claim on David than you do. Why do you want to curse us? Weren't we the first to suggest bringing the king back? But the comments of the men of Judah were more severe than those of the men of Israel. Okay, so let's just pause here. So everything is looking good for David. Everything is looking good. He forgives Shimei. He and Mephibosheth shows him tremendous grace and kindness. He shows kindness to this old guy Barzillai, and he's bringing in his heir of some kind, his progeny of some kind, Kimham, and he's bringing all these people over. But then the people of Israel come to the king and they're like, hey, how come the Judeans helped you cross over before we were, and we weren't part of it? And they said, you know, why did you let the Judeans sneak you away and not let us cross the Jordan with you? And the men of Judah are like, well, the king's our family. He's our close relative. Why are you getting upset? And they're saying, like, we haven't been eating from the king's table. We haven't eaten at the king's expense. Basically, we haven't taken anything from taxes, from public money. So back off. And the men of Israel replied, like, we have 10 shares in the king. Like, the king rules all the tribes. We're speaking for 10 of them right now. So why don't you back off? Right? Like, it's the classic calm down. No, you calm down. It's that kind of thing. And so this is going to lead to a problem, and we're going to cover that tomorrow in chapter 20 when we look at Sheba's rebellion, and because that's another fascinating little story. And actually, there's a story within a story in there. So I look forward to covering that material tomorrow. But what can we draw from this text? I think what we see here is that mercy triumphs over judgment. I think that that's what we need to see, is that mercy triumphs over judgment. However, Mercy triumphs over judgment, but when you're the king, there are always going to be people who are going to want to use the power of the kingdom for their own advantage, for their own gain, for their own position. And it is difficult to be a king. It is difficult to be an authority because it is very hard to know who is sincerely looking out for your best interests and who is only looking out for their own. A lot of lessons we can draw from this, a lot of lessons about human nature. Unfortunately, I already went way over time, so we don't have time to cover this. I'm really bad at doing this 15-minute thing. I'm not good at it. I'm double that at this point. But this is a longer passage of scripture, so I forgive me. Anyways, thank you for joining us for this Bible study. God bless. Bye.